what's going on now about the whole party scandal is a complete distraction from the actual, you know, what's going on in the real world. Those sorts of, you know, pointing fingers back and forth, the blame game, is just theater, you know, to get people, it's a dog whistle type of thing, to get people to react. Those that, you know, don't like, personally can't stand Boris Johnson, are immediately going to be hurling insults at Johnson and the Tory government. And then those who can't stand, you know, Keir Starmer and sort of the associated corruption of the, you know, champagne socialists on the left, the fake left, they're going to be hurling insults at them as well. So it's just basically a whole divide and rule distraction tactic again. And the real fact of the matter is that close to two-thirds, or maybe even more, people who are currently hospitalized or experiencing you know, severe physical difficulties or harm or illness are actually the ones who've been vaccinated. This is becoming more and more apparent. It's data out of Scotland, data out of Australia. Everywhere is revealing that the people who have been jabbed, are more likely to be experiencing health issues.
Yeah, but the thing is, those are the majority, aren't they? So depending on whose figures you believe, somewhere between, you know, around about 80% of people have been double or triple jabbed. And so you would expect the majority of people in hospital, just because that is the situation in the wider population.
Well, I don't know about the number of people who've been jabbed. I'm not sure if I actually trust those figures, because, you know, they may actually be, it's possible that they count the number of jabs based on the number of vaccines that have actually been distributed and the number of letters and requests that they've sent out to people. Who knows? I mean, it's just difficult to know now what they're actually saying is verifiable and true and what isn't. But, you know, in order to continue to say that people should carry on and have these jabs is just ridiculous, because there are so many people coming out now saying that they know people who are jabbed or double jabbed or boosted who are all coming down with either flu-like symptoms, cold-like symptoms, or any other thing which is debilitating, you know. And recently, the data that has been compiled and released that shows the most recent totals is that, you know, across the US, the UK, and the EU, is that huge numbers of people are being injured. Something like, let me see, 2.8 million people in total that are now on government authorized databases like yellow cards and bears and Eudra Vigilance for the EU. 2.8 million people have reported over 9.7 million injuries. And of those, some 61,000 have died. And, you know, this may only be 1% of the actual cases worldwide, because people generally don't report these adverse events because they don't actually know that there is a reporting system or that they're even connected or linked to the vaccine or the jabs. And most doctors and healthcare workers simply do not have the time or the inclination to report when somebody comes to them and says, oh, I suspect this might be connected with the injection I had. You know, they haven't the time nor the inclination to actually go ahead and report this. And on top of that, we know now that doctors are actually financially benefiting from the from giving out these injections. So they're getting £15 minimum per injection in the UK. And in the US, doctors are being compensated, hospitals are being compensated for giving out COVID diagnoses and then being treated with those patients being treated for with remdesivir or with the mechanical ventilation, and even being paid for a death certificate, putting COVID on their death certificate. You know, all of this basically adds up to a complete and utter corruption of best medical practice, and it incentivizes this whole process of categorizing everybody as a COVID death or COVID case and so on, you know. And so it's just a complete perversion of medical practice and of science. And so
sorry to stop you, Catherine, but are you saying that if a doctor puts COVID on a death certificate that they get paid more somehow?
They're being, yes, in the US, this has come out that they are paid a fee for putting COVID-19 on a death certificate. Now,
I suppose the implication there is that, oh gosh, you've been near COVID, danger money or something. But anyway, certainly it sounds like, you know, a bribe to me. You know, if you're being told that you as a doctor, if you put something on a death certificate, that you'll get paid more. I mean, I find that incredible.
It does sound incredible. And the fact that, you know, doctors are actually paid and this is confirmed, you know, this is not speculation, that doctors in the UK are paid £15 each for each patient that they inject, I believe. And that then they also have a payment for, you know, administering injections on a Sunday, for example, or a Saturday. They get, you know, weekend sort of double pay type bonus.
Yeah,
I
know.
Visiting
just,
people in
just
their homes.
My own GP, chatting to them, they got to the stage over the last few years where they are quite often offering vaccinations if you're going abroad, and then they get a little bit shirty with you if you don't have the vaccination. But they're not saying to you that they get paid more if they get the chance to give you that to inject you. So there's this whole financial stuff been creeping in to the health service where, you know, they've got a motive for you to say yes to a vaccination that you potentially don't need when you're going abroad. I mean, this is a hepatitis or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I mean, that the fact of the matter is that hospital, you know, there's a real crisis occurring across health sectors in the US, the UK, in Canada, where the health sector workers have, in the main, many of whom have taken the jabs themselves and are now being expected to get boosted. Many of them are now refusing to get boosted, or there are those who didn't even get their first and second ones and they don't want them. So in the UK, it's being reported now that they're bringing forward the date at which they're going to start sacking people in the healthcare sector, because they're calculating that in order for people to have both their jabs, first and second jabs, by April, the cutoff point, they should be all having their jabs by sometime in February, I think, in order to have that sort of 8-week window between the first and the second jabs. So they're apparently, according to an article in the Telegraph, I think, they're going to start sacking people in the NHS sector. And it's just astonishing because, you know, on top of all the issues about how it's completely insane to expect any healthcare professional or any healthcare worker to take a jab that, you know, doesn't prevent transmission, doesn't prevent contagion, and is anyway, at any rate, based on the original so-called sequencing of SARS-CoV-2, so that it's really totally irrelevant to any, you know, because SARS-CoV-2, if you're going along with that theory, the initial variant, if you like, has been and gone, and everything else now is a variation of that, and the jabs don't protect against any of those. So it's just complete and utter absurdity to expect them to take it now. So putting that really critical point aside, what's even more absurd, well, what is equally absurd and you know, quite dangerous, deliberately so, it is the fact that the health sector is already on its knees, and you know, they haven't announced or continued to sort of share this information, but the fact that it is known that the waiting list has grown to such an extent that it you know, it's something at like, what is it, between 5 and 7 million, potentially even more people who are currently now on waiting lists. You know, how on God's earth are they going to even conceive of processing that backlog if they start removing about 100,000 members of the NHS, their workforce, and then potentially continuing to whittle them down if they refuse to have subsequent boosters and so on? I mean, it's really, it's malevolent. It's very malevolent what is going on. That I can't see any other way round of looking at it. It's become the UK healthcare service has become more or less a single issue, COVID only service. I mean, I know there are some trusts that are, and some hospitals that are maybe trying their best to cope under these extreme circumstances, but it really, you cannot expect the issues that are currently facing the UK health, you know, the NHS and the population as a whole to be resolved if you are sacking professionals from this service. You know, it really, it's just something quite extraordinary. And the fact that that is not the focus of the news and of discussions is very telling. And I think this is partly why there's this, you know, this ridiculous party nonsense going on. Because there are much, much bigger issues at stake here.
Are there any other things you want to look at this week, particularly to do with the, whether all this lot makes sense? And because I know we've seen quite a lot of number crunching over the last, few months, and looking at particularly at the, the bigger picture, really, which is, for example, whether much of what we're being told really makes any sense when you start scratching the surface. That's what it seems to me anyway, that as soon as you start looking into things, you immediately realise something's terribly wrong, such as, incredible nonsense from the mass media, firstly over the whole Partygate business and whether, Boris Johnson should be moved out of the way for Liz Truss or somebody else. Because we're at this very important stage, the halfway period roughly, between general elections. And clearly, if Boris is not removed now, it's going to be much more difficult to do that in the future. So there seems to be a very concerted mass media campaign, not much else really, certainly nothing much going on within the Conservative Party. A few letters about the parties, eulogising of the words of Dominic Cummings, whereas a couple of years ago or 18 months ago, Dominic Cummings, 2 years ago pretty much, wasn't it? Dominic Cummings was the worst person in the world. No, 18 months ago, actually. Suddenly now he's great and everything he says is true. And then there's also in the background to all of this is the, well, it seems to me, complete nonsense about Russia being about to invade Ukraine. So much, it seems to me, is unhinged at the deepest level. And I noticed, by the way, that the British are selling anti-tank personnel, anti-tank weapons to the Ukrainian army, and the British soldiers are out there training the Ukrainians how to use them. So that seems to me as simple as that, that we're getting all this stuff about Russia being about to invade Ukraine simply as a kind of marketing pitch to sell British anti-tank weapons to Ukrainians without any kind of real pushback from the media. But anyway, so is there anything else you want to go into this week, Catherine, about the sort of bigger picture as to, things which are real rather than the nonsense we're being fed?
Well, I have been thinking for a while that, every time we discuss these things, and then your colleague Martin gets very irate, because although he, he can see how this potentially is, yes, it's a financial reset and it's a sort of global coup, and that there's more to it than simply a pandemic, and that yes, the mRNA experimental injections can be, could potentially be extremely dangerous and so on. But then, he still has this, this strong belief that all of this is part of, a war on China. That the virus is man-made, that it's a biological weapon, and so on. And so I've been thinking, for a while how to. A lot of people who sort of are looking at the alternative angle of this and are also kind of trying to pin everything on Fauci and the lab in Wuhan. They're sort of looking at it as, okay, this is a man-made thing, and let's blame Fauci et al. And so on. I'd like to address that. I'm not saying I'm an expert on this at all. It's just something that I think is actually quite believable. It's quite possible. I'm not saying that there's no research going on in these labs. I'm not saying they don't consider, they don't have gain of function type research, which is backed by, you know, the Department of Defense in the US and so on. But what actually happened, or what seems to have happened in this case, specifically to COVID, is that at the time, in December 2019, in the city of Wuhan, there are a few cases of people, you know, being ill with some type of pneumonia, which didn't seem to be, you know, it seemed to be fairly resistant to treatment or whatever. And so there were these poorly people. But the big context of Wuhan, which I think I mentioned in previous chats, Tony, was that, you know, the local government and the national government were quite nervous about Wuhan because they'd had already experienced a massive protest there in, I think, the summer of 2019, which was about the lack of, which was about, principally, I think, about the building of a massive incinerator on the edge of the city, which was going to exacerbate the air quality problems in the city of Wuhan, which was already very bad, and which had already, you know, which already sort of induces or creates a lot of ill health in the local population, specifically to do with respiratory issues, and that you know, they were very, there was a lot of anger and resentment and concern in the local population. So if you see the picture in this context, and then you see how something occurs in a hospital, and I don't know if there were nefarious actors. I can't say, you know, nobody knows for sure whether there were nefarious actors or whether people just overreact and get, you know, how rumors spread quickly, especially when your whole sort of raison d'être as a professional in a hospital is to look for potential, you know, pandemics, you know, preventing these sorts of things. So if you're very much, your whole life is dedicated to making sure that there are no pandemics, you know, developing, or epidemics developing, then any sort of sign would maybe trigger you to sort of become super vigilant about it and hype, you know, really hyper concerned about the issue. It was in December, it was literally just a handful of people. Okay. And so that what happened was that the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, decided they wanted to shut this thing down as quickly as possible. They didn't want any panic. They didn't want there to be a sort of pandemic and a rush on the hospitals with everybody claiming that they had some kind of a, you know, this strange pneumonia or whatever, and, you know, overwhelm the hospitals and overwhelm the systems. So they thought, we need to shut this down and basically ensure that it's known, it's not attributed as a human-to-human transmission. That we, you know, we've got to make it. We've got to make sure that it's recognized as a animal to human transmission, and that there is no human to human transmission. So they tasked this poor guy, Dr. Zhang. They tasked him with sequencing some of the fluid that they'd taken from these ill patients in the hospitals in Wuhan. And they said, basically, I mean, who knows what they said. But they said, sequence this thing and make sure, you know, make sure it's it's good for us, you know, make sure that there's no panic. And he sequenced this, well, I say he sequenced. So in 40 hours, apparently, Dr. Deng produced this thing that he then, you know, it came to be known as SARS-CoV-2. And that sequence was man-made. He made it. He cobbled it together in a panic, in a hurry, to try and make it look like it was a bat-to-human transmission and not human-to-human transmission. And the word, that sequence got shared around the world, and people started looking at it. And of course, because it was kind of very crude and cobbled together and didn't really look like anything anybody had seen before, they started attributing it to being man-made and to being some sort of gain-of-function type of creation. And so in a way, it looks like quite possibly happened was that this top-down control of an authoritarian government who wanted to prevent a kind of mass stampede to the hospitals in Wuhan, who didn't want any kind of any more controversy, any more bad press, simply wanted to be able to brush this thing off and say, don't worry, it's just a few cases of bat-to-human transmission. But because of this kind of subterfuge and sort of trying to brush things aside, trying to get rid of the problem, they exacerbated it. And I think this happens quite a lot in places like China, where they try to control a narrative. Instead of being honest and transparent and saying this is actually what's going on, that in fact there's no human-to-human transmission between any of these patients, which then subsequently they did present that research, because after the main sort of so-called epidemic in Wuhan, where as a matter of fact, all the deaths attributed to COVID in China, virtually all happened in Wuhan. Some 4,000 people that allegedly died from this SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 happened in the city of Wuhan. Not even many outside of Wuhan city in the province of Hebei. Most of them all happened in the city of Wuhan, a city that has over 10 million people. 4,000 people of a winter with people who already suffer from respiratory problems because of the terrible quality of air is probably quite routine and normal. And yet, the whole situation got blown out of proportion, and then the agents of darkness, the ones who had been simulating these pandemic scenarios and were literally waiting for this sort of opportunity, or so once again, who knows if there were nefarious actors based in China at the time who deliberately fanned the flames of panic and fear, but they jumped on this narrative, and they and the WHO and all the people who constitute the pharma, the health pharma business, jumped on this and said, "We've got ourselves an epidemic in China. Let's develop it." I'm coming to the conclusion that that's what happened, because after the few weeks of the height of the epidemic or whatever it was in Wuhan, they did a major citywide surveillance of 10 million of their inhabitants. And of the 10 million that they, I think it was just shy of 10 million people they surveilled. So they did a nucleic acid screening of close to 10 million residents of Wuhan in China. This was published in Nature magazine. And so they did this between May 14th and June 1st of 2020. So as early as June 2020, it became absolutely apparent that certain things are true. And the first truth is that there is no asymptomatic cases and there are no asymptomatic transmissions. So of the close to 10 million people who participated and who were screened, they detected 300 asymptomatic cases. Okay, of close to 10 million people, they detected 300 asymptomatic cases. That simply means those people had a positive PCR test. And then they tracked all of those people, all the contacts of those 300 people, and found that there were no positive tests amongst the over 1,000 close contacts of those asymptomatic cases. When that came out, and I remember seeing that study back in, I think, June or July 2020, I thought, that's it, case closed. This pandemic should, you know, this is over. The whole thing should be over. But nobody, you know, highlighted that case. I mean, that is an astonishing admission that there is no such thing as asymptomatic transmission. And furthermore, the fact that they screened some 10 million people in the country, they had apparently noticed, or they knew, that around 34,500 of those 10 million people had recovered from COVID-19 previously. And of those 34,000, 107 of them tested positive, even though, you know, they'd recovered from COVID, supposedly. So basically, first of all, 34,000 people who had supposedly COVID in the 2 months prior, or sort of February, March, April time of 2020, out of 10 million is really nothing. It's not an epidemic. You know, it's routine. That sort of figure is completely and utterly, totally routine. So it's not evidence of any kind of epidemic. Now, I can hear Martin Summons now saying, oh, but they lock down. They lock down and that's how they stop the spread. But there was no spread. You know, there was no spread even amongst the first few cases who were in hospital. These are simply people who, you know, who had lung issues or who had health problems, probably comorbidities, who, you know, were suffering as a result of the terrible winter air in a city like Wuhan. But, you know, as we know, there have been all these simulations the previous 10 years where they've been planning the big one so that they could begin to launch all of the other a sort of associated plans that they could plug into a global health emergency. And, you know, the SPARS simulation from the Rockefeller Foundation that was in 2017, once again, with Johns Hopkins University participating. The SPARS document basically pretty much mirrors what has happened in the last 2 years. But according to the SPARS document, that pandemic, their simulated pandemic, went on for 3 years. It went on for 3 years, and you know, vaccines, despite being harmful to some people, continued in the following years for about 5 years. They were continued to be used as a measure against this SPARS pandemic. And that seems to be what's happening now, is that regardless of how utterly useless and in fact completely counterproductive these jabs are, they're still digging their heels in. And insisting that people have them. So I don't deny this is quite possibly an attack on China, as well as, you know, other strategic partners like Russia. I'm not, you know, there are some people who think every country is in cahoots and that China and Russia are all in cahoots with the West on this game. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure that's true. And I think we do have to be very careful that, I mean, I don't know what you can say to prevent wars from happening. Because they literally can just sort of break out at the you know, just without anybody suspecting of it ever becoming a reality.
No, that's exactly what Alex Craner was saying about the war in Yugoslavia when he was living there 2 days before in last week's show. And, you know, that nobody thought that the war was going to happen, absolutely nobody. And yet suddenly in 2 days' time, it had. Also, you know, if you look at Britain and Germany's relationship in the run-up to the Second World War, you know, in some ways, Britain and Germany were in cahoots. You know, there was a very cooperative relationship between the then king for a while anyway, Edward VIII and Adolf Hitler. And also the Bank of England governor, Montagu Norman, was extremely helpful in helping Hitler to destroy Czechoslovakia in the run-up to the Second World War. But on the other hand, there was there was all this talk about, oh, how terrible Hitler is. So it seems to me that whether, you know, China, America, Europe are in cahoots here, on one level they are, but on another level maybe they're not. But I think what you're saying about China is particularly interesting because, yes, maybe an attack on China, but it looks now as if China is attacking itself because we've got now 20 million people in China under a very extreme lockdown over Omicron. That is in the cities of Xi'an and Tianjin, and another city now with another something like 6-7 million people, and Yang, where people are simply not allowed out of their homes because they've got the Winter Olympics coming along on February the 4th, and the Chinese Communist Party have decided that they must make sure there is no Omicron or Omnicon, whatever you want to call it, in China when that starts, which seems to be a completely impossible task, which the people of China are really suffering because of. And it's not just those cities where, oh, by the way, when Anyang this week was locked down, they only had two asymptomatic cases there. And that's then suddenly 5-6 million people are not allowed to come out of their homes at all for into the indefinite future, which just seems incredible. And there are four of China's biggest port cities, Shanghai, Dalian, Tianjin and Shenzhen, are all under lesser lockdown, but they're on under lockdowns nevertheless, except the ports are still operating. Now, the principle there is that, oh, they want to stop, Omicron coming in those ports, and yet they haven't actually stopped the ports operating. They've just locked down the population in those ports, which seems to me just bizarre. Anyway, I just wonder, you know, because surely the Chinese are attacking themselves. Nobody's attacking China anymore.
Well, it's completely reactionary, right? And it's like taking a hammer to crack a sesame. I mean, or even more draconian than that. I mean, it's just, or taking a road flattener or whatever you call those things. It's clearly they're desperate for the Olympics to go ahead. They know that, you know, basically, what is it, the US and the UK, is it, who pulled out? I mean, the whole future of sports now seems to be hanging in the balance, because you have these elite sports people who are, you know, collapsing on the pitch and, you know, basically, I don't know how many now, but there's increasing numbers of elite sports people who are unable to continue to play because of the heart troubles they're having or whatever it is, and even some dying. But the whole, you know, Chinese culture is about, a lot of it is about face and not losing face, and you know, always presenting things in an exceptionally good light, so that you know, nobody can pick fault with you. And I can see that the fact that they're locking down these whole into millions of people at a time is just the sort of crazy draconian policy to kind of say, look, we're ensuring the games go ahead. We're assuring there are, you know, there's zero cases. If they didn't test anybody, there wouldn't be any cases. You know, I mean, it's quite as simple as that. And if somebody presents with a cold, that's what it is. It's a cold. You know, that there's no need to categorize this thing anymore. The whole thing is a scam. The whole thing is a sham. And as so far as it's a bioweapon, I would argue it's not that. Not a bioweapon, because it's not actually killing people. What's killing people is the malpractice and the delayed treatment and, you know, the compounding of problems in hospital. This is actually, it's all fear. It's all driven by fear. And the fear porn, most of it is coming from the US and the UK and NATO states. China would be better served if they completely dropped the fear narrative. If, you know, but the problem is China is not an island. You know, as much as China may be a target of the West, it is still completely linked on so many levels with many, many other countries that are playing this game, that are signed up to this game. You know, China is a member of the World Health Organization. China is a member of the UN. China is a member of all these organizations. So it cannot simply come out and say, look, folks, there are no more variants. This whole thing is blown over. We've got a handle on it. There's no need to test anymore. There's no need to carry on with this. Let's get back to normal. I mean, it would be absolutely phenomenal if they did that. I don't know why they don't.
Well, China, in a way, is a sort of typifies this whole idea of incompetent and malevolent rulers. And this is one thing I'd just like to ask you about, which is the we've touched on this briefly before, which is this whole idea of selecting young people who have particular character traits, profile, and basically tapping them up to become the leaders of tomorrow, because we've seen so much of what we're seeing today, particularly the policies in New Zealand, which have been made popular largely by the press there. But when it comes to, they've only managed to do that because they've completely ignored in the press the dangers of these experimental vaccines and the basic principle that you shouldn't be experimenting on human beings, as you said, drummed up by the fear of the virus. With Jacinda Ardern being one of these people that's been under the wing of Klaus Schwab for many years and the World Economic Forum. And Tony Blair too, right? But I mean, that is just one of these groups. And I wonder what you make of these. We've got the Yale World Fellows, exactly the same sort of principle. The World Economic Forum do this. Yale World Fellows do this. The Rhodes Scholars do this, that brought us Bill Clinton. Literally, if you look through the lists of these world leaders, it seems now that it's almost impossible to make it as a world leader by being an intelligent person that cares about the public, that you've got to go through one of these programs and you've got to be tapped up as a teenager in order to be in charge today.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know if there was ever a time when you could a genuine, authentic, morally upright person was ever going to be promoted to the level of premiership or prime ministership of their country. But this grooming almost, I mean, that's basically what it is, isn't it? It's the grooming of these young people. To mold them into thinking a certain way. And incentivize them, and as I posted recently on Facebook, an article from Middle East Eye, which actually is an expose of a letter, an email that was written by David Manning, and you know, the comments that these leaders like Blair and Bush make are just so completely detached from reality. You know, in this email, I don't know if you've seen it, we're going slightly off track here, but this article in the Middle East Eye was published on the 13th of January. It's called How Bush and Blair Plotted War in Iraq. Read the secret memo in full. This email is printed out, but in full. And there's one part of it that I just thought it really speaks volumes about the complete derangement of these leaders. Okay, so it says here, the PM, and that refers to Tony Blair, the PM also told me that Bush had been clear that he wanted to build a broad coalition for his Iraq policy. This had apparently persuaded him to dismiss those on the American right who were arguing there was no need and no point in bothering with UN inspectors. Sorry, that wasn't the actual quote I was looking for. The part that I drew focus to, it says here, David Manning asks, we would still face the question of why we had decided to act now, what had changed. And that refers to, you know, the decision to act as in to take an aggressive policy on Iraq. And so he answers that. He says, the answer had to be that we must think ahead. This was one of the lessons of 9/11. Failure to take action in good time meant the risks would only grow and might force us to take much more costly action later. He goes on. The president agreed with Mr. Blair's line of argument. It was also Bush's view, though he would not be saying this publicly, that if a moderate secular regime succeeded Saddam in Iraq, this would have a favorable impact on the region, particularly on Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Well, I ask you, what was Saddam, if not a secular leader? I mean, we can talk about whether he was moderate or not, but he wasn't religious. Saddam Hussein didn't take a strong position on Islam or anything else. So what planet are these people on? And it's clear to me that either this email, which is recounting the discussions that Bush and Blair had when Blair went to Bush's ranch in Texas, where they had that face-to-face meeting where famously they disappeared off to dinner, leaving all their aides behind, and everybody was going, what the hell are they talking about? This memo is referring to that. And the fact that, you know, that their argument for going to war in Iraq was a preemptive attack, precisely what it was accused of being, was a preventive attack. And there's no basis of that in law. There's no argument for taking a preventive action when you're not under threat, where there's no evidence of real threat. So these two characters, Bush and Blair, they've been rewarded handsomely for their actions towards the empire. And you know, it's clear that the only way, seems to me, that the empire can carry on is to put their puppets in place. I mean, I think more and more people are becoming wise to this fact. But what's going to be the outcome of all this? What's going to be the result of the mass collapse in trust in all these institutions, the collapse in trust for the executive, the collapse in trust for the media, for the mainstream media, the collapse in trust of doctors and of the judicial process. It seems to me that if they want to, if they are really, I think they are now very, very concerned about this complete collapse in trust. They will have to try and manufacture another crisis. And so, you know, there's talk of the next crisis, which Klaus Schwab has famously already suggested would be the next one, is a cyber attack. And of course, any type of cyber attack can be completely manipulated, and they could easily lay blame, you know, do a false flag and lay the blame on one of the countries that they are targeting, such as Russia, Iran, or China, quite conceivably.
Well, this is one of the great absurdities of NATO policy now, is that they have stated that if there is a cyber attack, they would consider that an act of war, and that they would reserve the right to reply militarily, you know, with aircraft bombing, tanks on the ground. And yet we've got this absurd situation, as you've just pointed out, that a cyber attack could easily be spoofed, or a ghost attack from it could be from Israel on America, for example, then blamed on Russia or China. So when there is a cyber attack, there's really no way, apparently, with the most sophisticated methods they've got now, of having any idea where it's from.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on it. Incident like such as that, you know, I think it would have such dramatic ramifications that, you know, you wouldn't have time for a careful, methodical, you know, combing through of the data. Things could suddenly spin out of control before anybody has got to grips with the facts, and that's presumably, you know, why they would want to do it like that, because the last thing they want is for people to get to grips with the facts.
Well, yeah, you could say exactly the same for the September the 11th attacks and for COVID.
Right, precisely. Everything which is hugely driven by fear and then by division, it is a cocktail for, you know, the worst possible outcome. And I think that the lessons, if anything, should be drawn, is that anybody who pushes a fear narrative has to be suspect. I'm not saying you shouldn't be cautious and that you shouldn't weigh up all conceivable scenarios, but feeding fear is always a very suspicious activity. But I do wish that, you know, China, they have a real problem. Because they're very fearful of internal rebellion, any kind of internal movements. And there, obviously, there are groups now that have been financed by the US and NATO and so on, that are attempting to stir things up in China. And these same groups are unfortunately getting involved in the truth movement. And so what I'm really concerned about as well is the fact that many in the truth, so-called truth movement, have bought into this whole idea that that is being kind of pushed quite hard by sectors in Canada and Australia and the US, that, and presumably from the UK as well, that China is the big bogeyman in all of this. And that the whole, the whole corrupt cabal at the top is pushing for a communist world order. I mean, that is the most bizarre kind of conspiracy theory that I think people really have to think long and hard about, because these, corrupt corporate cartels at the top and the banksters at the top, the last thing they want is a communist world order. What they're pushing for is feudalism or neo-feudalism. It's not communism. It really gets on my nerves when, you see these posts that bang on about the fact that this is a communist takeover or a socialist takeover. I'm not saying that there aren't sectors on the left that aren't trying to somehow benefit from certain angles of this. I mean, but it's not a communist plot.
Well, look, the irony of that is that we've got this police crime courts and evidence bill going through, what a lot of people have been calling the police state bill, which is, I mean, if you look at what they're actually planning with this, this is really shocking, because one of the things we like to boast about in the West is freedom, our freedoms. This is going to be another massive crushing of those freedoms. So the police arbitrarily can impose a start and a finish time. So that could even mean that they give you only a 5-minute or a 2-minute protest time, even if there are thousands of people that want to attend, or tens of thousands or even millions. They can also set noise limits for the protests, making sure that, for example, you don't disturb a conference, that you're there to disturb, and apply the rules to a demonstration by just one person. So, I mean, it's unbelievable, really, basically it's a kind of telepathy clause in it, where people could be arrested, charged, and imprisoned but for something they ought to have known about, even if they hadn't received any direct orders from any police officers. So this is an incredible piece of legislation, but it looks to me as if the only pushback against it within Parliament is from the feudal House of Lords. Well, it's not all feudal. Obviously, most of the Lords are life peers. They're not the big landowners anymore. Or the dukes or whatever, they're the only people pushing back against this, Catherine.
Yeah, and I think this is a point that UK Column is trying to get through to people, but it doesn't seem to have got very far, is that there's a sort of political divide on this police crimes and sentencing bill. And that the opponents to it, or the protesters for it, or against it rather, is predominantly coming from the left, and presumably the hard left as well, and groups that support things like Extinction Rebellion and so on. And there's very little support, seems to me, to be coming from the sort of the groups that have now coalesced around the anti-lockdown and anti-mandate, for COVID, the sort of freedom movement. And yeah, once again, it's this the way that us, the 99%, if you like, the way that they have still got us corralled in our corners, to some extent. And that's, you know, that's the problem, is that all of the measures, all of the legal structures that they have been bringing in over the last 2 years are part of what Mike from UK Column likes to call the enabling acts. And what they're enabling is a neo-feudal order. And so these acts will literally, all of these pieces of legislation will turn the UK into a banana republic, into a tin pot dictatorship, into a country such as the one that I currently reside in, where you literally cannot oppose the state. You literally cannot say a thing against the policy of the state. They will no longer be able to say anything about defending our values and defending our freedoms, and, you know, we're so that everybody envies us for our values and our freedoms, because it will all just be a joke, because there's nothing left. There are no values, there are no freedoms left if these laws go through, and many of them already have, like the CHIS Act, the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Act, you know. We're living in interesting times, as they say.
What you said about Extinction Rebellion being sort of organizers of this, and the anti-lockdown groups not, well, these two groups are kind of seem to be almost set up as being opposed to each other, even though, of course, when it comes to protest, they've got very, very strong common aims. And I can tell you, we had a demonstration here in Bristol last Saturday with 1,000, 2,000 or so people doing a very, I thought, well-disciplined, peaceful protest outside the main police station, really just showing the police, saying, well, look, you know, if you want to battle with us, we're here to oppose that, you know, and there's lots and lots of us, much more than there are of you. A very, very, very mature, a wonderful protest, I thought. But that was, the whole thing was organised by Extinction Rebellion. And of course, they are not in any way cooperating with the anti-lockdown groups.
Yeah. And somehow we've got to build bridges. I mean, a lot of the Extinction Rebellion crowd, because they're so far on the left of this, and they've completely bought into the fact that this pandemic was real, and, you know, that everybody should lock down and everybody should wear a mask and everybody should do this and should do that, because that is going to, you know, end the pandemic sooner than later. I don't know how deeply entranced many of these people are still about the reality of the pandemic, or the lack thereof of the pseudo pandemic, and whether they will come around to the fact, because that's quite critical, so that, you know, these groups can then try and build bridges of connection, because they. I mean, I know Extinction Rebellion is, people say it's not top down, but there's definitely people at the top who are receiving funds deliberately in order to push the Agenda 21 and the Sustainable Development Goals and the, you know, all of that zero carbon nonsense down everyone's throats. But equally, there are many people who joined Extinction Rebellion or whatever groups like that, because they are genuinely concerned about the environment. And I think there needs to be some sort of, I don't know, some way of reaching them about the way that the green movement was taken over, and how the actual issues that matter, like real pollution, you know, the real degradation of natural environments and of habitats and so on, and how all of those things have been completely pushed to one side. They are non-issues under the whole zero carbon Agenda 21 narrative. And to get those people to open their eyes to the utter greenwash of what was at one point, at some level, an effective environmentalist movement. But again, that got completely captured and diverted. So if those two groups could come together, then it would be, I think, pretty invincible. I mean, it would be much, much stronger.
I don't think that's going to happen because as you say, of the control and funding by the Extinction Rebellion people that run it. I mean, they've got a professional media operation with, you know, professional PR people contacting. Even I get contacted from time to time by XR, you know, asking me to take a certain line on something. And also the other thing is they're actual organisers at the meetings. They're doing all sorts of liaison meetings with all sorts of other groups. Goodness knows where these people find the time, but they're very young and efficient, super efficient, you know, getting all sorts of names and contact details and all that sort of thing from everybody. And it really is run as an incredibly professional organisation. But having said that, at Saturday's protest, we had to stand around for like over 3 hours listening to the whole protest was supposed to start at 2. And when it was nearly starting to get dark at 4, the speakers were still, well, I should say speaking, but I'm not going to say that. I'll say waffling on about things that everybody kind of knows anyway. And it was almost seemed like an exercise in demoralisation. All these people that had turned up to have a bit of a Kill the Bill march around town ended up just standing there listening to, and most of them had gone off to go and carry on with shopping or whatever. So it was a very bizarrely, you know, well, it wasn't organised and it certainly didn't stick to the timetable. And it ended up making people think, well, what's the point of coming here, standing here, just listening to people rather than we want to have a little bit of a march around town. So it was interesting to see how Extinction Rebellion organised it. And although, of course, it's a Kill the Bill thing, they're liaising with Extinction Rebellion. And Extinction Rebellion have got the muscle and the manpower to sort of push it on and carry it through. But like you say, it's a very, you know, insular when it comes to the wider protest movements out there. Obviously, the anti-lockdown being one of the biggest at the moment, it almost seems to be designed to create fissures in protest movements around the UK. Anyway, look, we've come to the end of our time. I just wonder if you've got anything else to add finally, Catherine, before we say goodbye this week.
No, I think we've covered quite a lot, haven't we? So, yeah. It's all theatre, and try and see it as such, and try and pull out and watch for the bigger things and the real issues, the real issues that matter. And at the end of the day, you know, stay away from fear as much as possible, and just try and be really rooted, grounded in reality and in fact.
Yeah, flex those discernment muscles to figure out which are what out there is authentic and what isn't. Because yes,
it's not easy, is it?
Well, it isn't, but it's, you know, it's, I think it's important to be aware that we need to be. I mean, I was just chatting to a couple of older chaps yesterday. They've had all their vaccines. They feel as if they've been doing the right thing for society, but of course they've been duped. And you know, so I think we just need to have a bit of healthy scepticism. Anyway, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome, Tony. Bye for now.